Hi, everybody. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is September 28th, 2023, and we're talking with Jose Rodriguez Romaguerra. Jose is an assistant professor in the departments of psychiatry, cell biology and physiology, and applied physical sciences at University of North Carolina School of Medicine. And he's also affiliated with the Neuroscience Center and the Carolina Institute of Developmental Disorders there. Jose's lab studies neural circuits responsible for arousal and motivated behavior, and he uses a combination of behavioral measurements and some optical methods to extract a host of physiological phenomena like arousal indicators, like heart rate and pupillary dilation, but also brain activity, neuronal activity, and specific neurons in brain regions related to the behaviors he studies. Hi, welcome, Jose.
Hi.
I hope I didn't get any of that too wrong.
That was perfect.
And also with us today is Tony Burgos Robles. He's our local expert on some of the same topics and a regular on the podcast. Hi, Tony.
Hi, John.
And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. So, Jose, just to get us started, you study arousal, which is a word that gets used a lot in behavioral neuroscience. I think it does not always mean the same thing when everybody says it.
Absolutely.
So maybe you could start by telling us what is arousal as you define it, and how is it measured, and what's its function in behavior, especially in motivated behavior.
Yeah, so many times the way I like to express what I'm studying is by differentiating between arousal state and arousal responses. Many times the field uses the term arousal state when they're referring to like sleep-wake cycles, going from like sleep to wakefulness, and which is a very dramatic change in arousal. What I study more is more arousal responses, which is just those dynamic responses that happen in arousal when you're awake. So the best way to define what I'm interested in studying is by explaining what I use to measure arousal. So for example, a lot of researchers use pupillary dynamics as one of the measures of arousal. And one of the things that we see whenever you have different type of stimuli is that those dynamics or that arousal response is gonna dilate and sort of get bigger. And then many times that response will go immediately down or continue to go up or stay up for a longer period of time. So it's thus those arousal dynamics that happen upon multiple stimuli presentation. So it's more of a dynamic definition rather than a state definition.
And what is it that causes arousal? I mean, I'm sure is this, I mean, even pupillary dilation is part of the lie detector test and stuff like that. So we must know a lot about it.
Correct. So there is, for example, neuropeptide systems. Many times when we talk about arousal, it's referred to norepinephrine system, dopaminergic systems that are sort of driving the global states of arousal and even the dynamics of it. So arousal, it's a dynamic change that's going to be driven primarily, originally, from these broad neuropeptide systems.
So they have some function in learning and behavior? Is it
absolutely
need to be aroused in order to learn something?
Absolutely. So a lot of times, many times, other definitions of arousal are referred to more in the domain of like attention. So like you need an arousal response to be attentive to a particular stimuli. So that is something that is required for somebody to learn an association between two stimuli, for example. So definitely.
And what is the primordial role of arousal, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, right? Because it seems that it's like that response that your brain is producing at the physiological level that you cannot hide, right?
Correct.
You know, behavioral changes, perhaps, you know, we human individuals can hide or try to mask, but the physiological response not, right? And that's why one of the reasons they use, you know, something like this for lie detection, right?
Absolutely. I think that's very interesting because, as I said, it's a response. So it's something that we're not in control of. It's going to happen whether we want to or not. Mm-hmm. I believe that arousal responses across species are one of the most primitive responses that are going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then you come in
with more cognitive process and how those arousal responses are interpreted, mm-hmm. and then how the system and the species react on that to induce and sort of behave.
Right.
Right.
I'm just wondering, you know, why is it not considered like an emotional reflex, like response?
Like if you're right? walking through the forest and you look down and you see a rattlesnake in the trail, you don't even think rattlesnake in the trail. You've already reacted to
exactly.
it. And it must be an enormous arousal response if you were measuring my eyes when I happened.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that kind of reminds me of like the Joe LeDoux theories of like the high road and the low road, whereas you have like the low road that's not as cognitive to produce a fear response when you see that snake in the forest. Yeah. Similar example to what he used, as opposed to like a more cognitive high road that you need. And then specifically, once you want to overcome those fears, then that's when even the more cortical road comes in order to be able to regulate those states, which is something that Tony works a lot on and we worked on during our graduate studies together a long time ago.
Right. And it seems that, you know, again, you don't need to be in a conscious state in order for those arousal responses to happen. You know, they just happen. And you gave today a fascinating talk about how you measure it and how you try to make sense of, you know, what is the animal being presented with. And it doesn't matter what is the valence, the emotional valence of the cue presented. It seems that the arousal responses happen in very similar manners.
Correct. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of our initial studies, we kind of like dialed it down in terms of behavior and just started with something very simple. As I talked today, we just started with odors. An aversive odor, a rewarding odor. And then the arousal responses that we have when we smell those odors. Not we in part, you know, the mice, but in the responses that mice are having when they smell these odors of like opposite valence. So one of the things I really think, which is underlying to our conversation, is that these arousal responses are kind of not valence specific. Like the valence process is something that's going to happen afterwards. And that, but again, those are, we need to design better experiments to also get at what comes before, like the valence identification, the arousal response. Is the arousal response happening simultaneously with the valence identification, or is it something that happened after when you present these stimuli? So there's right. probably like different groups of neurons that are involved in doing, this is just a theory, but arousal based on valence mm-hmm. versus arousal based independent of valence.
Right. Well, thinking about different neural circuits producing different kinds of reactions or deep brain functions like arousal versus valence, then you may think perhaps more, and correct me if I'm wrong, valence, emotional valence being highlighted by amygdala systems and then the bed nucleus of the striatum terminalis, which is, you know, where you're looking for neural responses, is doing the more arousal-like responses, regardless of the valence.
You can be equally aroused by something good and bad. I just wanted to clarify this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is supersedes that. It's like, or maybe precedes it. The arousal system may not be informed about valence at the time that it kicks in. Is that possible?
Yeah, correct. And like the preceding and the ordering of things, that's why I sometimes, as I did today in my talk, I really like to go back to the original psychological theories. For example, when James Lange started talking about that you have an arousal response that can lead directly to an emotional state, whereas then Kennan and Bard started talking about how you can have a stimuli that has an arousal response and an emotional state that kind of happen independently and in parallel. And then Sachter and Singer came later with a two-factor model saying, no, you can have an arousal response that drives an emotional state, but that how that arousal response is going to be driving that emotional state is going to be driven by a cognitive label that's given to that arousal response. So, like, there's a process in which that cognitive label, which I refer to more often as, like, valence, is happening. So it's, like,
that's one of the things that I think we need to figure out as a field of how that cognitive label gets applied to an arousal response that then turns into drive the emotion, or as we can study in rodents, motivational behaviors.
Right. I like, you know, the approach you're taking, because you're getting into the details of separating, again, these two functions, right? Mm-hmm. If you go back to the normal textbook diagram of amygdala circuits, you know, the circuit will show amygdala is processing sensory information, is assigning some emotional or valence. And then there are outputs to the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, which you're investigating. But in that circuit, then whatever is happening in the bed nucleus is dependent on what is happening in the amygdala.
Seems backwards.
Yeah, it seems backwards. Mm-hmm. So, but you're saying, no, I'm investigating rapid arousal responses, which are happening even before there is an emotional valence being set.
Correct. So then the input to the BNST is probably coming from somewhere else.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very good way of looking at it.
Yeah, I'm actually not familiarized with the inputs to the BNST. Are there like direct sensory inputs from thalamic areas, for example?
Yes, absolutely.
To the BNST?
Yeah, yeah.
All senses?
Yep.
Yes?
Yep.
That's really
so
cool.
It's a matter of identifying what inputs are coming to the BNST and like, for example, what norepinephrine inputs are coming in. So like the NTS, for example, is one of the major inputs of norepinephrine into the BNST.
Yes.
So it's like, how is that happening? And
what?
The NTS. Nucleus, what's
nucleus
it?
Of the solitary
NST
track.
NST is a nucleus solitary track.
Yeah.
This is a like taste.
It's kind of like the other major source of norepinephrine.
Yeah. Okay. And what do you think is happening specifically with the set of neurons? Again, remind me again their name.
Proprionociceptin neurons, which is the genetic precursor to the nociceptin neuropeptide. So we can use that as a way to identify the small group of neurons in the BNST.
What is nociceptin?
So nociceptin is one of the major neuropeptide systems that has been studied widely more as like nociception for like pain sensitivity.
And
but it's not peripheral. This is, I mean, nociception, I often think of as a definition of a peripheral stimulus, like C fibers or something like that. But you're talking about a peptide that's activated in the brain.
Correct.
When there's a painful stimulus or something like that.
Correct. And it's actually fascinating how these neurons that produce this neuropeptide are actually widely distributed across many brain regions. But one of the things that we found originally when we, during my postdoc work with Gerrit Stuber, and so Gerrit Stuber, Tom Cash, Michael Brukes, and Tom Yu developed this transgenic mouse line to look at cells that express proprionociceptin, and they started finding that there's a group of these neurons that are found in like the peri-VTA that the Brukes lab was studying, other ones that are in the central amygdala that the Cash lab was studying, and then the BNST that we were studying in Stuber lab.
Yeah, and they are widely distributed.
And what we started finding is like all studies converge in that they're involved in some type of motivationally salient processing.
Yes.
So motivational stimuli are driving them.
Yeah, you were talking about nociceptin during your talk, and I was like, is he talking about some kind of emotional pain? What is happening here? Because, you know, like you think about pain, nociceptin, but then you're talking about hyperarousal states, and it's not specific to negative emotions. It's, you know, also positive valence stuff. I'm wondering what is going on here. Is this just because neuromodulatory systems work in weird, complex manners like this typically? Because you also mentioned that in one of the earlier studies, neurons were categorized based on gene clusters, that were expressed by individual neurons. Were there other genes that were highly regulated or upregulated in these PNOC cells as well?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And one of the things that we did is, because one of the things I showed today was that you kind of get these, like, from the PNOC population in the BNST, you get these neurons that are either getting excited to a motivational stimuli, inhibited to a motivational stimuli, or just not changing at all. Right. So we already have like three types just by defining them based on excitation inhibition. Right. And we did some single RNA sequencing where we looked at if there were genes that can separate the PNOC neurons into clusters. And what we found is that you have some genes that can separate. We have four genes that can separate them. And they are kind of like a lot of the main players that have been studying within this region. So you have somatostatin, CCK, and PKC delta.
Wow.
And then ZIK1, but ZIK1, not many people know what it does. But even just those three could be like defining our excited versus inhibitor versus no change neurons.
Huh.
So it's like one of the things that we're really interested in doing is sort of parsing that out to see, like, by just genetic identity, can we parse out these different response types of neurons based on motivational assailants?
Right. You mentioned somatostatin, CCK, and what else? And PKC delta.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
And then the other thing is another interesting question is whether you have, for example, somatostatin PNOC positive neurons versus somatostatin PNOC negative neurons, to see if like the ones that are PNOC positive within that populations are the ones driving arousal versus the ones that are PNOC negative or not.
Right.
So that's
further
interesting questions, right, that I think.
Yeah.
These fast
stem from this work.
Changes in firing rate, we normally don't attribute them to peptide transmitters.
Sure.
We don't know as much as I don't know about this, but it seems like the peptide transmitters are usually not carrying the main electrical signal there somehow modulating, and that's why they get called neuromodulators. So I'm wondering if we defined neurons by the presence of a peptide, like let's say I took substance P, I took every neuron in the brain that had substance P, I'd find them in many different brain areas. The substance P neurons in those different brain areas are not necessarily part of a unified system that have anything in common with each other.
Right.
The substance P neurons over here might be doing something completely independently of the ones. But it sounds like you think maybe the nociception neurons are involved in nociception, sort of no matter where they appear in the brain, which would be a very cool thing.
Yeah. Correct. But it's something, one distinction that I like to make is that we are studying cells that have this genetic marker. We're not studying neuropeptide function.
Right.
Which is two very different things.
Right.
So we're just using the nociceptin, the pre-nociceptin gene as a way to study a group of cells.
Right.
So it's very different than like studying actual neuropeptide function within these cells.
Exactly, because what is modulating their response to external stimuli is like whatever input is reaching to them, right?
Like that.
Yeah, yeah. But then the subsequent question is, where are they synapsing into or onto? Because it's not only that they are producing these markers, but their main neurotransmitter is GABAergic, because you showed that more than 85% of those PNOC positive cells are also GABAergic cells.
Right? Yeah.
So it's very complex. It's highly
correct.
Complex.
And when they project to, and something that I think it's also interesting of this specific circuit is that we did some electrophysiology, some patch clamp experiments that Jim Otis did in the lab, where we found that PNOC neurons inhibit non-PNOC neurons within the BNST, but actually also inhibit other PNOC neurons. So I think it's also very interesting that with the data that I showed today, we have some neurons that, in specifically in the aversive odorant experiments, where we have neurons that are getting excited and inhibited.
Oh.
And then in the positive valence odor, we have neurons, the majority of the neurons are being excited, not inhibited. So that already also suggests that perhaps the ones that are in the aversive domain could be a different population that's causing the inhibition,
right,
because we know they're connected.
Right.
So more anatomical
and functional connectivity need to be parsed out amongst these cells.
Right, right.
So this is something, because the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis is not a large venous nucleus in the brain that's known to be comprised of many different parts, as sort of like the hypothalamus is, or like the thalamus, for example. It's always been considered a nucleus about which we did not know very much, and which two different parts of it look approximately the same. But now, always happens when we look close, we suddenly discover now that there's a host of different cell types. They are different genetic markers. They have different connections. They use different transmitters. And they are preferentially located in different places in the nucleus. And so this small, fairly poorly understood nucleus starts to turn out to be a little brain of its own. And we have to answer questions like how much of what it does is internally organized by the connections within the nucleus, mm-hmm. and how much of it is determined by connection differences to different parts of it that come from other places.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So do we know that, you know, we know something about the inputs to the bed nucleus, but do we know that the place where the PNOC neurons are is specifically gets input from some place and specifically goes to some other spot? And can we actually break up this little miniature brain into a bunch of different things?
So we don't know anything about the inputs to PNOC neurons. That's something actually we're going to be doing something soon. It's like rabies tracing to see from where we get inputs to then study how other input structures are modulating them. What we do know so far is the outputs. So as I said, there's some interconnections, as I was explaining before, that go into PNOC positive neurons and both PNOC negative neurons. But something that's very interesting is that where they project to is very specific to two brain regions, what we found so far. That we only see projections out of the BNSD from PNOC neurons to the medial amygdala and the medial preoptic area. And those are two regions that have been widely studied for their role in like social behaviors, whether it's like social defenses behavior or like sexual behaviors. And that's why I think one of the things we're doing now in the lab is trying to figure out if the PNOC neurons that are specific to these projection targets, one, if they're separate, they're two different type of neurons, the ones that project to one region versus the other one. Second, their genetic identity. Now that we know that we can separate PNOC neurons into four types, then it's, you know, are the ones that project to medial amygdala like somatostatin positive or like PKC delta positive?
Right.
And then, so do both genetic and projection specificity allow us to parse them out?
Right.
And then overall, if potentially this is a specific mechanism that you have to then, rather than just arousal, if these specific projections are going to be specific to like social arousal.
Right.
That's one of the things that we're really interested in doing now, and a lot of like the collaborations that me and Tony have been starting have been to develop tasks to study more social behaviors, in particular social threat behaviors, social reward, but doing it in more from like learning paradigm that
right.
we go back to our original roots.
yeah. I mean, it seems that these are highly complex mechanisms and systems, and all I'm wondering is, you know, like just because of the high complexity of all these neuromodulatory mechanisms, is that, you know, causing just a whole lot of noise, background noise in all the other major components of the brain? And the truth is that if you just, you know, try to get rid of only one of these specific neuromodulators, then you see a whole gamma of deficits right across. You know, it could go from social related deficits, or it could go into mood deficits, and so on and so forth. And that means, you know, I mean, they are there, they are very important, they are highly complex. And my question at some point is, you know, like, where is the end? You know, like, are we any near to fully understand how these neuromodulatory networks work, or what else is needed? What are we missing, right? And that's perhaps a big question, and I don't have an answer for it.
And as you're saying that, I'm thinking of like the neuromodulatory systems, the what we're getting with all the single cell sequencing, that we now go into like these clusters of neurons, and like we can segregate neurons in different ways, like, and then we find a function within one particular cluster of neurons or one particular group of neurons. Then the question is like, okay, can all the other subgroups do the same thing, the same function? Or are we actually going to be able to parse out based on cell type identity? Right. So it's, I feel like a lot of the field is kind of going to this, like, sometimes I refer to it in my mind as this like cell type game of like parsing out function based on cell type, similar to what we were talking about before, where you have anatomy before, or traditionally we've also looked at anatomy based on like site architectonics, but now that we're looking at like differentiating cells based on genetic content, are we remapping anatomy based on where these cells are found?
Yes.
And like that's not following the normal rules of site architectonics.
Yeah.
Like it's like we had a, it's kind of like the way to think about it is we had a map of the world, we're looking at the countries, and they're like, oh, but we can use site architectonics to look at states.
Right.
And then within the states, now we have all these neighborhoods,
right,
and towns. And it's like, how deep can, or towns and neighborhood in that direction? It's like, how deep does the sort of segregation of function, right, happen within the brain?
And I'm sure if you talk to our colleague, John McCary, he will tell you there's also epigenetic reprogramming happening here, also contributing to all these changes.
So our cell types are not necessarily static. Mm-hmm. Once you've decided a cell is expressing a certain set, exactly, of proteins, it doesn't mean it's going to do that forever.
Exactly.
So if you call that a cell type, you have to allow for cells to change their type,
right,
over time.
Right.
And how much of that do you want to allow? And some,
right,
call it a cell type.
Right.
So we are, the whole business of cell types is, right, fairly complicated for us.
Yes, and tricky, really, because sometimes it allows us to go into these directions that may not be the right ones to, study cells, different, mm-hmm, groups of neurons.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's kind of, it's giving us a route to, mm-hmm, isolate groups, mm-hmm, but then is that the right strategy? I sometimes even question whether we should be, rather than studying cells in isolation based on their genetic component, should we be studying them based on their function?
Mm-hmm.
So one, mm-hmm, of the really new strategies that I really like, some of the stuff that we're doing in the lab, is that, you know, let's forget about genetic identity. Let's look at all cells and then just identify cells based on function and then manipulate them based on functional identity, mm-hmm, rather than genetic identity, and then be able to manipulate them with optogenetics based on that functional identity.
That would be great if we had a measure of function that we believed in.
It's like, no, but it's like the measure of function. Yeah, correct. That's another thing. It's like, then we're the measure of function is then correlating to like the change in pupil,
right,
or the change in with one particular behavior, and it's
and then you don't know what it's going to do in some other behavior. So that cell's function is,
yeah,
now described in the context,
right,
of some very limited,
correct, right,
but idea of function.
I think you're doing the correct thing to do, the correct strategy, which is look a specific set of cells, but from different angles, right?
Yeah.
Collecting information about them from, you know, their genetics, from their function on a specific behavior versus the other or other, gaining as much information as you could, only we will actually try to make better sense of what they are about, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Just like there's a hierarchy, though, of this anatomical hierarchy of complexity that we're looking at, there's a kind of behavioral hierarchy of complexity too. And some of the behavioral things that we study are fairly subtle and rely on sort of hypothetical psychological states or,
right,
hypothetical psychological variables that nobody really can see. We think they must be there. But arousal, maybe arousal is more than just pupillary dilation of the,
yeah,
heart rate, but there's such a clear measure of it. It kind of is in a category of its own. It's not a cognitive, hypothetical entity.
That's a very good way of saying it, because one of the things I think is arousal, at the end of the day, is a psychological construct, right? And sort of pupil heart rate changes, respiratory changes, all these physiological dynamics give us a window into trying to figure out what the arousal state or response of the animal is. But at the end of the day, it's a psychological construct developed by psychologists many years ago.
Because we don't think that the pupillary dilation is the most important thing about arousal. This is kind of unstated fact about our thinking, is that we think arousal is enabling some kind of brain function or like hyping up some circuit to make it possible to learn from your surroundings better or, I don't know, sure I'm saying this wrong, but arousal has a kind of psychological function, and presumably the same neurons that are making the measurable physiological things are making that psychological thing.
Sure. If this is correct to say, like, it's part of the background code affecting emotions up here, right?
Correct. So it's like, a lot of the times I think arousal is going to provide some type of like gain to
some
emotional
gain,
processing. Fine-tuning properties to emotional processing.
Right.
It can backfire on you. Like enough arousal can paralyze you.
Correct. And like that's one of the things I'm really interested about it, is because coming from the fear and anxiety world, many times we define anxiety disorders, PTSD, as subjects being in this hyperarousal state from after they were presented with a stimulus that shouldn't be inducing that hyperarousal state that paralyzes them, right? Like a panic attack. So I'm really interested in sort of identifying what are the secret mechanisms that make that dynamic, or actually wouldn't be that, make that dynamic change, that prevent that circuit from being dynamic, because it's kind of like stuck. Mm-hmm. And then once it's stuck, then it's going to affect how you behave.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps an error in the signal processing, right? That is triggering that state from perhaps BNSD and causing the issue. Yeah. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Sam.
Yeah.
And
thank
Tony,
thank
for
you.
Joining us. That's,
it was a pleasure.
I feel very aroused by it.
No, that's the thing.
I mean,
it's like, we have to be careful. Yeah. But it's true. It's like arousal is many things.
Yeah.
Arousal can be, anything can induce arousal.
Well, this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.